Whether or not it ever becomes truly conscious, artificial intelligence can do mind-boggling things, like learning languages without ever having been programmed with any kind of dictionary. It works by looking for patterns in absolutely enormous amounts of digital information, more than any human brain could ever process. So if big data algorithms can find a way to translate Spanish into Swahili, could they find patterns in animal vocalizations and tell us once and for all if other creatures speak? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Tom Mustill is a biologist turned filmmaker and writer. His interest in whales was supercharged by what you might call a fluke accident. He was kayaking with a friend when a humpback whale leapt out of the water and landed almost directly on top of their tiny craft. It's a miracle that they survived and that onlookers managed to videotape the whole scene from a nearby boat. That footage went viral, of course. Mustill was briefly a global sensation, and the things he heard during that time about other people's close encounters with whales made him desperate to know. What was that creature thinking when this all happened, and how would the world change if we had some way to ask? Mustill's new book is called How to Speak Whale, A Voyage into the Future of Animal Communication. Tom, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a delight to join you.
We should be clear right off the top that it's great that everything turned out okay when you had your too close encounter with this humpback whale, but as it was happening, you really thought you were about to die. What do you remember thinking when you reached the surface and drew your first breath again?
Well, the first thing that I thought was, it was a two-person kayak, and I was with my friend Charlotte, and the humpback had landed on the front of the kayak where she was, and I was convinced I was going to die, and then I was convinced I was dying underwater, and so when I got through the surface, I turned and I saw her face, and she was smiling, and the first thing I thought was, I just couldn't believe that she was alive, because I'd already sort of it had been so clear to me that she must have died. So it was just joy that she was okay. That was the first thing. And me too, obviously. I was pretty happy to be alive myself.
When you tried to tell the friends you were traveling with who were like back at the cabin what had happened, they didn't really get it, right? You said a whale landed on us, and I guess they thought you were using just like a fanciful turn of phrase.
Yeah, I think it's pretty hard to get across, obviously, because if a whale jumps onto you, you'd assume that if it really landed on top of you, you'd be sort of smashed up. And it was the last day of a big group holiday, and I'm sure when you've been in this position with friends, they're all keen to sort of pack up all the bags and cook breakfast, and they were worried we'd get fined for late checkout. So when we turned up, like really wet, shaking, Charlotte was having a panic attack and crying. And sort of mumbling about this whale encounter. I don't think our friends really kind of clocked how serious we were until the video came out. Mm. But nobody believed us. I mean, we were paddling back to shore, afterwards with our kayak tour. And there were young, students, children coming out with teachers. And we shouted at them, a whale landed on us. And I think maybe because we were British and it was in California and we just seemed a bit out of place and strange. No one seemed to pay us any attention at all. So it was all a bit unreal, to be honest.
So then you become this, 15-minute celebrity, and you're doing interviews with news outlets all over the world, and you start hearing from all these other people who've had strange experiences with cetaceans. Just give us a sense of something that you couldn't get out of your head after somebody told you.
Well, I mean, yeah, we became a sort of lightning conductor for anybody who'd had a story. I met a Hawaiian big wave surfer who said that a mother humpback had brought its calf to him and that he'd swum over to it and it swam around and danced with it in the water. A woman told us that a humpback had saved her from being eaten by a shark and put her onto its back. I met a man who had almost been engulfed by a humpback that was lunge feeding, which when they take big gulps of water. I met a woman who said that she'd swum with dolphins, bottlenose dolphins, which are another kind of cetacean. And she said that the dolphin had paid her lots of attention and ignored the other people who'd been in swimming. This was in the with wild dolphins in the open ocean. And then when she got back to the boat, She said, why was that dolphin hanging around me so much? And they said, oh, well, that dolphin's pregnant at the moment. And the dolphin had been investigating her. And then a week later, she found out that she was pregnant. And she wondered whether the dolphin, with its echolocation, could sense that about her and was inquisitive. I mean, I've been sent hundreds of stories, which is a great privilege, really, and made me understand how few of these stories really get shared or believed.
I remember years ago there was a little Cuban boy named Elian Gonzalez who the craft he and his mother were on trying to get to the US ran into trouble. He survived, and the story he told as like a 5 or 6 year old was that a dolphin had helped him keep his head above the water. And at the time you think, well, it's just a kid and he was confused, but reading your book made me think maybe he was, telling an accurate story.
I think, I mean, there's a really long history that actually stretches back to ancient Greece and into many indigenous stories of dolphins coming to the aid of drowning sailors, or interacting with people and helping them. And I think for a long time these were thought to be myths or tall tales, but recently we see that, like humpback whales, for instance, seem to come to the aid and help other whales when they're in trouble. I've filmed them, humpback whales, trying to keep orcas, killer whales, off, to stop them from feeding on the body of a grey whale calf that they'd killed. And there's over 100 incidents of humpback whales seeming altruistically to put their own lives at risk to stop other species from being killed. And that sheds an interesting light on these ancient and recent anecdotes of humans being helped by dolphins and whales.
How long have we known about the vocalizations that whales make, if that's the right
Oh, it's
word?
only, well, it's a bit patchy because I think for the general public, whales and dolphins didn't really make any sounds. They didn't think that they were anything other than sort of large fish, really, until about the 1950s. And the only people who really, apart from indigenous cultures who would hunt them or interact with them, the only people who really spent much time observing whales were people who were hunting them, whalers. And there was a healthy discussion within the whaling community about this. But some whalers were absolutely convinced that the whales and dolphins made sounds because they could hear them scream. They'd report it, and they'd when they hunted them. And sometimes the calls and of anguish of the animals would come up through the ropes that were attached to the harpoons. And this has been described in contemporary tales from the 19th and 20th century. But really, in popular culture, most people didn't really think that cetaceans made many sounds until relatively recently. Maybe the 1950s and the 1960s was the beginning of it, and that was just with a few species. And then it's exploded since then to the place we are at now, when we realize that they're some of the most sophisticated sound makers on this planet.
This brings us to the extraordinary Roger Payne. How did he end up making whale sounds, his life's work?
Well, he actually, well, so Roger Payne was a biologist, and he was actually studying hearing in owls. And he heard that a whale had washed up on a beach, and he went to visit it. And it actually was a large dolphin, and somebody had cut off its dorsal fin and carved their name in its side and stuck a cigar in its blowhole, which is the breathing hole, the sort of nostril on top of their head. And he was so upset by this, he decided to change and to study cetaceans, because he thought surely only somebody would be capable of doing such a cruel and barbaric thing if they really didn't understand the entity that they were dealing with. So he set out to learn as much as he could about whales, and he got a tip that a man had a navy engineer called Frank Watlington in Bermuda had a recording from a Navy underwater listening station that I think was set up to listen for Soviet submarine activity that he thought might be related to whales. So he flew to Bermuda, and Frank played him this absolutely astonishingly beautiful record that he made.
I love hearing stories of the accidental benefits of different disciplines coming together. So Roger Payne earned his living as a scientist, but he's also a talented musician. Why was that important in the kinds of discoveries that he and his wife Katie Payne would make?
It's such an interesting point you make because, in a way, perhaps if Roger hadn't been a musician, if Katie wasn't also a musician, many of the whales that we have today would be extinct. When they went, because Katie was with him when Frank invited them aboard his boat to play them the recording he'd made, he played them these long, beautiful, complex sounds, and he said, "I think these might be whales, and I don't want you." I didn't want to share them with the whalers in case they used them to hunt the whales, but I think you could use them to save the whales. And Roger and Katie took them away, and Roger, as a cellist, listened to them again and again and again. And he lay in bed with his eyes closed, listening for hours and hours. And as a musician, he started to realize that there were repeated patterns in them, and that they seemed to last like performances of about 25 minutes. And then the whales would pause and then repeat the performance. And when they analyzed scientifically these patterns, they found that they were analogous to patterns in our music. They had verse, chorus, verse structures. Katie found that they seemed to employ rhythm, which they think might be a way the whales use to remember the complexity within the songs and rhyme. And they had lots of other different sort of structures that we have within our human music. And when they investigated this as musicians, they found that they were right, and they got the front page of Science, the journal, and it was a huge revelation because until then, really, we knew a lot about birds singing, but we didn't really think that other animals sang, and that these giant animals could have such complicated, huge, beautiful songs, was a game changer for the whales, and they probably wouldn't have noticed if they weren't musicians.
The songs of bowhead whales have been compared to jazz. Why is that?
Well, they're kind of different. I mean, I don't know if you've listened to bowhead whales, but whereas humpbacks, to me, because this is very subjective, seem, yeah, sort of like the pieces seem very coherent and you can kind of get a feeling of almost where they're going if you listen to them a lot. The bowhead whale ones are kind of more far out and a bit strange and surprising. So I'd say maybe a bit more like sort of contemporary jazz rather than like Miles Davis or Duke Ellington. But that's, but they change all the time because bowhead whales, there's so many different whales and they have different songs, and humpback whale songs evolve and change every year. So the songs of a decade ago, just like our pop music in the humpback whales, they change so much that it's hard to make a big generalization about them. And I suspect that a lot of the times, the researchers who listen to them, they hear elements of the music they themselves love in the music that they hear from the animals.
Let's listen now to a little bit of humpback whale song recorded by the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. I did want to talk to you, Tom Mustel, but I have to say I could listen to that for hours on end. It sounds a little bit like the string section of an orchestra tuning up.
Yes, absolutely. And I had the privilege in the research for the book of going to swim with humpbacks while they were singing. And there's a whole component to it that you can only really feel, which is the infrasound, which is below human hearing. And when you're near one of these singing whales, your whole body vibrates. You almost become part of its voice, and all your chest and your sinuses and all the air spaces in you just kind of hum. And it's a extraordinary feeling, a bit like being really, really close to, like, I don't know, like a 30 double basses tuning up or something like that. You just kind of fizz with the sound of it.
What clues might exist within whale bodies and whale brains that could tell us something about their capacity for complex communication?
Well, this is a fascinating area, and I was very lucky because I'm In my television work, I'd met a woman who's a comparative anatomist called Professor Joy Breidenberg. She's at Mount Sinai in New York, where she teaches human anatomy. But what her real passion, and she's one of the world experts on this, is the bodies of whales and dolphins. And she's dissected over 100 whales. And I was with her for three dissections of a fin whale and a sperm whale, another fin whale. And she showed me inside their bodies. They have, well, there's two different kinds of whales, the toothed whales and the baleen whales. The toothed whales have teeth. The baleen whales have these kind of toothbrushy whiskers in the place of teeth. And they have slightly different ways of making sound. But really, what you can see is that they have tremendous, like when you get inside, you see they have loads of nerves going to highly complicated sound-producing organs, which take up very large amounts of their bodies. For instance, the sperm whale, its sound-producing apparatus is almost a quarter of the size of its entire body. That, you know, if you look at a dolphin or a sperm whale, that big lump on the front that we call its head is actually like a really expanded nose. And they make sounds by kind of making that sound that you'd make if you try and make sounds using your no nose, but using all these other organs and tissues for amplifying and focusing and the sound. And then they receive the sound through their jaws, through these deposits that run through their jaws, and they're taken to their ear auditory processing centers, which have loads of nerves. They have a lot of their brain is devoted to it too. So when you have an animal that devotes a lot of its brain to a particular sense, you know that it's something that's very important to it. And I was present at the scanning of the brains of two whales using CT and MRI scans, and they're enormous and they're very wrinkled, and they seem to have these neurons that we have, us humans have, and we thought only humans had. So there were hints all throughout their bodies that they're absolutely exquisite producers, receivers, and processors of sound. But the biggest clue is just in the amount of sound, amount of the variety and complexity and ubiquity of the sounds that they make, which we're only just starting to be able to hear.
Tom, do scientists consider it appropriate to talk about whale song as a form of language?
The word language is very loaded because traditionally only humans were considered to have language. Despite the fact that most linguists who decided this had never studied any animal apart from humans, and a lot of the biologists I've spoken to find this very frustrating because over the years we've discovered that many of the parts of what make up human natural language, other animals seem to be able to do them too, like semanticity and the syntax and other and forms of meaning in the structures of our communications. We found other animals employing them too. So the goalpost, every time we discovered this about another species, the biologists complained that it seems like the definition of what language is keeps being continually changed. So I think it's easier, rather than to say language, to think of meaningful communication or animal communication systems. Perhaps we don't need to get tied up on whether animals have exactly the same kind of language as us. Roger Payne uses the term whale speak. And I think probably most people, if they heard that sperm whale mothers teach their young how to hunt giant squid using particular sounds and communications that are unique to their clan, and they can't understand, and they don't speak with those communications to other whales, and they seem totally unique to being passed down orally. And they teach them how to survive. They teach them how to communicate. They teach them how to hunt and navigate in the deep, how to look after one another in creches while they hunt deep below, and how to tell one another apart. That dolphins seem to have signature whistles, which are analogous to names for themselves that they learn. I think. And that they use sound to basically coordinate such enormously complex lives, and that in captive animals we seem to have been to have discerned that they can understand complex sound-based and other languages that we teach them that aren't human language, but communication systems that show the thinking capacity for understanding things like questions and the order of things and the manipulation of other people, or and they have self-consciousness, they recognize themselves in mirrors. when you know all of those things and you understand how good they are at making sound and what a big deal sound is to them and how their complex their communication systems are, then I think most people just think, okay, cool, that's a kind of language. But if you're really into language, if you're a linguist, you might say that is not exactly language. And so maybe I think it's best avoided getting caught in knots about whether it's human-like language. And more, it's more interesting to discover what is actually there and how they're using it.
Tom, we don't know, of course, whether whales receiving communication from other whales are responding only to the sounds of it, or whether their bodies are also feeling the kind of vibrations that you described when you spent time with humpback whales. But what happens if somebody takes a recording of a whale making sounds and then plays that recording back for another animal?
Well, playback experiments have been a big part of terrestrial biology, studies on land. We've often tried to figure out what animal sounds mean by playing the simplest one back to the animals that make them. So, famously, with some kinds of monkeys, we've played their alarm calls with vervet monkeys. They make different sounds depending on what kind of threat they're perceiving. And by playing the different sounds they make back to them, we noticed, or the biologists noticed, the monkeys would either run up a tree to hide or stay close to the ground or run up on out on a branch. And they realized that the different calls responded to leopards, eagles, and snakes, and that those three responses to the alarm call were the right thing to do. You know, you want to be out far on a branch if there's a leopard because it won't be able to get you out there. You want to run up the tree if there's a snake, and you want to hide down below if there's an eagle. So alarm calls have been one way that we investigate what meaning might be in the communications of other species. And that's a form of playback experiment. With whales and dolphins, it's really hard because they make such complex communications. We really don't know what we're playing back to them or how to effectively monitor their response to see what meaning the calls might have. But one very famous story was that of Humphrey the Humpback, who was a humpback whale who got trapped in the San Francisco Bay. Researchers there, including Diana Reiss, played. They'd been totally frustrated for days and days, and the whole nation was watching and very upset that this whale, once it got up into the more freshwater parts, would be unable to feed, and its skin would start to deteriorate. And they were really worried for its life, or be hit by a boat because it's a very busy shipping lane. They'd been playing loud bangs. They'd been trying to drive it back out to sea with boats. But what pulled it out was that Diana Reiss and other scientists played the sounds of other humpback whales, and the whale turned around and swam towards it. And that's how they helped, I guess, sort of lure it or encourage it back out, and it swam out under the Golden Gate Bridge to safety. Quite what that whale thought it was hearing and what the whales might have been saying in those recordings is still a total mystery. But that's the really exciting thing about some of the more recent research using artificial intelligence, is that we can start to maybe hone in on some of the patterns within these enormously complex communications and see what are the simpler units in them. And then eventually, when we have theories about what they might mean, we now have the technologies to record and watch the whales and listen to them underwater as we play the sounds back to them and see how they respond.
So I described that AI very briefly in the beginning, and perhaps not as certainly not as thoroughly and accurately as you can. So how can computers possibly help us learn about whale speak and what it might mean in a way that direct human observation will never match?
Well, I guess machines can help us with whales because direct human observation is almost impossible. Whales swim very fast. So even if you're lucky enough to be in the sea and you're lucky enough to have equipment that allows you to survive and there's visibility and there's whales there, they don't tend to be around for very long. And it's very hard to get an accurate recording as a person. So we're very limited. And one incredible thing that machines can help us with is in gathering the recordings of whales. And I witness people who've designed things called wave gliders, which are self-propelled kind of sea robots that drive around, and they can be used to self-pilot themselves across whole oceans, recording lots and lots constantly of whale sounds. And the first things that AIs can start to do is to go through these really long recordings, both from vehicles like that, or hydrophones on the seabed, or recording devices placed on the bodies of the whales themselves with little suction cups. When you record these tens, hundreds, thousands of hours, no human being could listen in their lifetime through them. So machines can process, they can do a lot of the kind of drudgery, and they can separate out when there's a whale, speaking and when there isn't a whale speaking, for instance. And then they can also look and say, okay, well, what kind of sound is it making? Which category does it go into? Is it a song? Is it a communication call? Is it an echolocation? So they can do a lot of the kind of process recording and then processing and legwork. And that really helps because it gives your biologists a nice data set to begin to analyze. But Google Translate, which many of us use, and other computer translation techniques, the reason it's very good is it can do something that no human linguist or translator can do, which is if you it runs off systems of software analysis of AI and other machine learning techniques, where if you give it hundreds, thousands, billions of communications, it can find patterns within human communications in one language and kind of make a giant galaxy map of the relationships between all the words in the language and how they're used with one another. And it can, if you do that with two languages, you can actually fit that galaxy map of all those words and their relationships onto one another, not based on a person saying, this is a dictionary from French into Spanish, this is what one word means in another, but just by the geometrical relationships between all the words and the universes that those two languages are representing using words. And that's how Google Translate is so effective. It can sense, or sorry, not sense, it's a tool, but it can pull out patterns within human languages that no human is aware of in order to be enormously effective at translating. And the reason that is so exciting to so many biologists now is they've been overwhelmed. And I went to conferences when researching how to speak whale of bioacoustics researchers, and they all had all of this audio data because now we've got these great machines that can record things that we can't hear and they can go where we can't. But we're really, we've only got human brains and human ears to try and tease out patterns. And suddenly you have these analytical tools that we've developed for finding patterns that are hidden within our own communications. And they are so excited to start pointing those tools towards animal communication systems to see what patterns they might discover within them. And I think a really interesting analogy is we don't know what we're going to find, what patterns we're going to find. Will they be language-like? If they are language-like, will they be like our languages? With whales and dolphins, we know that they make loads and loads of different kinds of sounds, and they have, as we've described, these different vocal cultures. But, how will they put them all together, and will they be meaningful in the way that we understand it? Who knows? This is a bit like the invention of the telescope. We didn't know what we'd be able to see when we pointed telescopes to the skies, and most of us didn't even think, that there were things there in the big gaps between the stars that we could see with our eyes. But with things like the Hubble, and now the James Webb Telescope, whenever we pointed at what we thought of as a blank patch of sky, we see these things that we didn't even realize existed. And I think that's the kind of feeling that these biologists have now. They have this fantastic tool for looking, and they want to point it at animal communication systems that we really struggle to get a way into to see what might be there.
So this all leads to the question, Tom. I mean, if you could directly interact with a whale, what would you want to ask it?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question. And I think we should. I know this sounds a lot like science fiction, and I thought a lot of this was quite like science fiction. And in the 4 years I've been researching the book, I've gone from thinking that to thinking that the people who are doing this with these huge projects, in fact, there's like a massive one off the shores of Dominica underway right now, trying to map the communications of sperm whales with the aim of communicating with them by 2026. I thought that was sort of crazy sounding, but now I think the people who are doing it are so like competent and I've seen how the technology works, I think it might be feasible. I wonder if we should at all talk to them. We don't have great histories of making contact with one another. And I think we should perhaps, once we've taken on that perhaps we could do this, maybe pause and just listen for a bit longer. And I think if we were then convinced that it would not harm them to be spoken to, because imagine if a whale started speaking to you out of nowhere, it might blow your mind, upset quite a lot of the things that you live for and think about. I think I'd ask them, like, how are you? How can we help you? I think those basic questions are very important because, you know, the seas are in trouble at the moment. They are changing due to the things we throw in them, due to the way we treat marine life. And those effects are being felt by the whales tremendously. We run them over by accident. We catch them in nets by accident. We do awful things that we don't mean to. And perhaps they could help us to treat them better. But then I think, on a level outside that kind of practical, I would love to know what they think of us, because you know, like, it's so helpful to have somebody else's perspective on you, and I feel that it is a very lonely thing to think that we are the only real conscious thinkers on Earth, the only talkers on Earth, and to feel like we had fellow travelers with different perspectives that might in bring more wonder to our lives, that might allow us to look at ourselves differently. I think that would be really, really interesting. And hopefully not too crushing if they said something cruel. But I don't think so. I think that maybe they'd say, like, why aren't you fatter? You must get cold fast.
They might not say anything cruel, but they might beseech us to leave them alone.
Yeah, I think we do not know the how destructive our sounds, for instance, are to them. Because we are so visual, we can't really understand how damaging it is to live in the sound world that we have invaded with our underwater explosions and outboard motors and other human sounds like big undersea mining and drilling rigs and shipping tankers. When the coronavirus pandemic stopped a lot of ocean traffic, scientists noticed that the whales seem to be talking to one another. Sorry, they seem to be vocalizing in far more complex ways than they did without that. So it seems like we're sort of really making their life very difficult. So yeah, I think they would probably ask us to just be quiet so that they could talk to one another better, or even to us better.
Tom Mustill is a biologist, filmmaker, and writer. His book is How to Speak Whale: A Voyage into the Future of Animal Communication. Tom, it has been a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's been a real pleasure to join you.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. On our website, think.kera.org, you can sign up for our new newsletter. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.